All the guilty people, they said they've all seen the stain on their daily bread, on their Christian names. I cleared myself, I sacrificed my blues, and you could complete me, I'd complete you. His eyes were the color of the sand in the sea, and the more he talked to me, you know, the more he reached me. But I couldn't let go of L.A., city of the fallen angels.
The Slate Family Foundation Legacy Program was created to support artists who have dedicated their lives to music and who now struggle to maintain mental wellness and an adequate standard of living. Loneliness and social isolation are key risk factors for mental health conditions later in life. This May, during Mental Health Awareness Month, the Unison Fund is asking you to support Canadian legacy artists and musicians. For more information on this lifeline of hope, visit unisonfund.ca.
Good evening and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba.
Our guest this evening is Vicky Leadham, co-curator and gallery manager of the Hannah Pescher Sculpture Garden, founded by Hannah Pescher and Anthony Paul over 40 years ago in an ancient Surrey woodland in the UK. Their collection grew from a handful of sculptures to more than 200 pieces, with a selection of artists from across the UK and Europe, to enhance the main theme of the sculpture garden, the powerful relationship between art and nature. The garden on 10 acres of land was redesigned and replanted by Anthony Paul, the award-winning landscape designer, and each sculpture is placed in harmony with its surroundings to create an amazing synergy within the environment. As a commercial gallery, the Hannah Pescher Sculpture Garden exhibits these works and sells to a global clientele. The garden opens to the public in April of each year with an annual exhibition of works in the collection alongside new artist works. Originally curated by Hannah Pescher until her passing, the exhibition is now curated by Vicky, working alongside Anthony Paul, and includes a wide range of works with styles ranging from figurative to highly abstract and innovatively designed using contemporary metals, wire, glass, ceramics, and plastics, as well as the more traditional stone, wood, and bronze. In 2022, a custom-built indoor gallery space honoring Hannah Pescher and continuing her legacy was added to house smaller, more fragile sculptures, ceramics, and delicate works better displayed indoors. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you so, so much for inviting me. What a lovely way to be spending what is here in Surrey in England, a rather dreary, drizzly, and windy afternoon.
Hannah Pescher's sculpture garden has a brilliant history. Would you like to share the story of how the sculpture garden began?
Oh, of course, yes. And it's one of those stories that we take great pleasure in telling because we are such a small organization and it really is, it's a passion project is how it began. So Hannah Pescher, the founder of the sculpture garden, was a Dutch lady and originally from Holland. She started her professional life not as an artist or a curator, but actually as a model and an actress. So over here in the UK, we had an incredible model actress in the 60s called Twiggy. And Hannah was basically the Dutch version of this. I have seen photographs of her back then, and my goodness me. So Hannah grew tired of this glamorous lifestyle that she had in Holland with being a model and being an actress. And she decided to enroll in journalism school over here in London, specifically political journalism. So very different from this sort of celebrity lifestyle that she had. At the same time, her future husband, Anthony Paul, had just come back to the UK. So Anthony is originally from Cobham, which is in Surrey, not far away from the Sculpture Garden, actually. But his family emigrated to New Zealand when he and his siblings were children. And Anthony told me many years ago that if you're a young man growing up in New Zealand and you're not interested in rugby, you have to find something else to make yourself interesting and to make give yourself something to do. And so he discovered a love of plants, a love of nature, and what better place than New Zealand? So he and his identical twin brother, and they are still identical. If they're both wearing hats, you can't tell who is who. It's slightly unsettling. They spent their formative years escaping their boarding school and going for adventures in the countryside and learning about the plants, learning about the trees, learning about the bird life right there in the midst of it. And this fueled something within Anthony. And when he made his way back to the UK, amongst all sorts of other jobs that he did, at one stage he was a shoe salesman on Bond Street in London, selling very, very expensive fancy shoes. He was a taxi driver, all sorts of strange things. But one of the things that he picked up was starting to maintain people's gardens and these little private squares that we have in London. He started off by just mowing the lawn, clipping the hedge, that sort of thing. But because he had this affinity with plants and trees, he started to see ways that people could improve these spaces. And so he started to suggest ways that they could change it, they could improve it, new things they could bring in. And this is how Anthony actually started on his garden design career, not by going to a design school and learning it formally, but literally from the ground up, from his hands in the dirt, getting to know the plants and getting to know the way to work with the ground and the structure and everything. So Anthony is starting to build his client base, he's starting to do more design work, he's really beginning to get a foot in the door of the landscape design industry. So meanwhile, Hannah is in London at journalism school. Anthony is also in London getting some garden design clients. And one day, Anthony's brother said to him, I've got us some dates for this evening. Now, my girlfriend is bringing her friend with her, and trust me, you do not want to stand this lady up. So Anthony begrudgingly goes along to this bar and he looks across the room and he sees where his brother is sat and his brother's girlfriend. And then he sees Hannah and he says that everything else paled into insignificance. The stars aligned and it was just love at first sight. They fell in love and it's all very romantic, really. There should be a Hollywood film made of this, I think. They fell in love. And they bought a little house in Richmond, which is in southwest London, did it up. And they decided that Anthony had been doing a lot of projects for other people, but he'd never done a garden for them. He'd never done a green space for them, somewhere they could call their own sanctuary. So they started to look outside of London, in Surrey. And as luck would have it, in a Sunday paper, they saw Black and White Cottage, which is the cottage at the heart of the Hannah Pesher Sculpture Garden, advertised. And this is the mid-1970s at this point. So they came down to have a look and were surprised by what they encountered. Because the gentleman who owned the property at the time was quite eccentric, as country folk are sometimes. And it was this beautiful black and white cottage surrounded by about 8 acres of land at this point. And the grounds were completely overgrown. It was absolute chaos. They could only just about get to the cottage. And they thought the cottage was very interesting. There was certainly potential. It needed a lot of looking after, put it that way. But it was the grounds that they were interested in. And so I like to imagine them like jungle explorers at this point, hacking their way through the jungle of the garden with the explorer hats. And there were weeds up to their eyebrows. There was fallen trees everywhere. But underneath all this chaos, they could see the bones of something quite interesting. There was obviously an ancient garden buried beneath all this chaos. And they managed to hack their way halfway down the garden. And they discovered this enormous Gunnera manicata, which is a huge broadleaf plant. The leaves are about 6 foot across in the summer and they can grow up 8 foot in height. And then they die back completely over the winter. So it's the most amazing magical plant. And Anthony had never seen one that big in a private space before. So he went back to the vendor and said, I have to have that Gunnera. How much do you want for the house? Because I have to have that Gunnera. And the guy said, gosh, I haven't seen that plant in 10 years. Didn't know it was still alive. So they bought the property and started the unenviable task of making it habitable. So Anthony is a landscape designer, as I've mentioned, and his visual language, as it were, is to paint in big, broad brush strokes a very limited palette of plants. So he uses plants in huge, broad swathes across the landscape, and he's very interested in structure. So the sculpture garden itself is a very, very green garden, and it's something that Anthony has nurtured over the last 50 years. But he always looks at what is the humidity, what is the atmosphere, what is the light versus shade, because he strongly believes that you shouldn't force plants to do something that they don't want to do. He wants to encourage plants and grow plants that feel in their natural habitat. So he started replanting the garden, re-landscaping the garden. They built a dike to divert floodwaters away from the cottage. They rebuilt a weir. So we have a beautiful big weir that is roaring like crazy at this time of year. And after a few years of incredibly hard work, Hannah decided that the garden deserved something extra. Now, she'd sort of grown tired of journalism by this point. She decided it wasn't really for her. And as luck would have it, she went back to Holland to visit a friend of hers who was an art curator. And this curator was putting on an exhibition of contemporary ceramics in a barn in the countryside, just outside of Amsterdam. And the maker had bought so much work with him that it didn't all fit in the building. And so you can see where this is going. So rather than sending it back or ignoring it, they just placed some work outside and thought, oh, people might not pay any attention to it. This was 1982, I believe, by this point. And so it wasn't really the done thing. Over here in the UK, we had artists like Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth who were creating work for outside, but it was very much more in a formal setting or a sort of a more monumental setting, whereas these pieces of contemporary ceramic were being just displayed against a shrub, under a tree, whatever, sort of in quite a natural setting. But Hannah saw these pieces and it was like a light bulb went off. It was like an epiphany for her. She realised what they could do in this beautiful, natural, lush woodland garden that they'd created. The way the light and the shadows were dancing across the surface of these works, you know, that beautiful contrast between this contemporary artwork and this natural backdrop, she knew what they could do. So Hannah came back to the UK and started approaching some London art schools. She started approaching the tutors specifically and explaining what she wanted to do and saying, have you got any students or ex-students who you think might be interested in this? And thankfully, she got some resounding yes. Hannah, I have to say, was the type of person you couldn't say no to. So I met Hannah in her late 60s, and even then, she was an absolute charmer. She was the kind of person that if she walked into a room, everybody just turned around and looked at her. She had this incredible persona. She was beautiful. She held herself wonderfully. So it's no surprise that back in the 80s, no one could say no to this new project that she was putting on. And so the first exhibition that Hannah held was in 1983, and it was about 20 to 25 pieces thoughtfully displayed, not throughout the whole garden, because of course a garden takes a lot of work to get to, well, it's taken 50 years to get to the point it is now, but she placed these pieces, but she placed them so carefully so that they had a relationship with their settings. There was a sense of synergy, and she wanted pieces to be in harmony with their surroundings. So they were framed by tree, textures or colors could be mirrored in the piece, sort of creating a story in that little section of the garden. It was very much about giving each piece of sculpture its own space to have and to create a pause as people were walking around. Anthony was a little bit nervous about this project because he knows the people of Surrey and the South in the UK, and we are quite traditional. We don't necessarily like someone coming in and saying, no, this is how you should present things. This is how you should look at things. But the way Hannah had placed these very contemporary artworks within this setting, it really captured people's imaginations. it touched them in ways that they weren't expecting it to. And so being something so unique at that stage, Hannah has been credited with changing the face of British sculpture in that she created this movement of including art and nature together, creating this relationship between the two. And that is something that is so fundamental to what we do today. So 40 odd years later, it is absolutely pivotal to everything that we do. Every consideration that we make is all about art and nature in harmony.
Can you tell us a bit about your background, education, and what drew you to the sculpture garden?
Of course. And to be honest with you, I'm really glad you've asked this question because this is chapter two of the Hollywood film. So, are you sitting comfortably? I first went to the sculpture garden with my village school when I was 5 years old. I grew up in the next village. So the sculpture garden is in a village called Ockley. And we are in an area called the Surrey Hills, which is an area of outstanding natural beauty. It's now called a national landscape, but I think the previous title is better. And all the villages around us all have names that are tree related. So Oakley, which is now Ockley. I lived in Wallace Wood. The next village is Forest Green. And we've got Oakwood Hill. I could go on, honestly. So we are in an area of ancient woodland and it's all about celebrating the woodland. So I went to the village school and I grew up in the countryside. And we had woodland behind my house. And I used to go and explore the woodland. And I used to make things. I didn't make dens, which is what a lot of kids make in the woodland. I used to make things, objects, which I didn't really know what they were. But even at the age of 6, 7, 8, they were obviously kind of abstract sculptures, which is quite cool. So my village school went to the sculpture garden on a school trip. And I don't remember much, but I remember meeting Hannah. I have this snapshot in my mind from well over 30 years ago of Hannah welcoming us all. And I don't remember much of the artwork, but I remember how green it was. I can still remember thinking at that time, wow, this is amazing. This is like a fairy tale landscape. And it obviously had a huge impact on me because I had always been creative and my parents had always nurtured this in me. I was an only child and I was always drawing and making, and our downstairs loo turned into my art gallery. The walls were just covered in pictures that I'd done. And I went to art school. I was interested in sculpture. Didn't paint. I was always making 3D things. And I sort of forgot that the sculpture gardens existed. And I went to art school. I did a sculpture course. And at the end of my degree, I knew that I didn't want to be an artist, or certainly not try to make a career out of being an artist. I loved making and I still love making, but I loved just doing it for me. But I didn't want to leave this world that I'd discovered. And it was then that my father said, oh, you should write to the lady down the road who runs the sculpture garden for some work experience. And I thought, oh, this would have been quite helpful through 4 years of art school to have remembered this was just down the road instead of plodding up to London or down to the South Coast. But I wrote to Hannah, and I did. I asked for some work experience. I asked if I could come along and clean sculptures for a couple of weeks, just so I could see the other side of that table, that other side of that conversation. You know, I'd spent 4 years training to become an artist and meeting artists and learning everything from that point of view. But actually, I was quite interested to understand what the other side of that world might be like. And as luck would have it, they were looking for a new assistant curator. And this is the days before online job websites. So finding replacements took a bit longer. And I went along, met Hannah. I must admit, I was terrified of her. She was quite intimidating. But we just clicked. We clicked straight away and she offered me the job on the spot, even though I had no experience whatsoever. I was literally straight out of art school, having been a waitress at a pub in my spare time. But she took me under her wing and I learned everything from her. She was my mentor and she was the most incredible, inspiring, charismatic lady. I also, to be fair, I learned a lot of what not to do and how not to deal with people. But that's part of life. And so I've gone on and done other things. I did leave for a little while to help a friend of mine open a gallery up in London, up in Islington. It made me realise that I am a country bumpkin, which is a very English phrase. It means that I am destined to stay in my wellies. I am much more happy in my Wellingtons than I am in heels. In fact, this time yesterday, I was in waders in a pond, fixing a pond pump. People think that being a curator is terribly glamorous. It isn't always, but I much prefer being outside in the mud, I have to say. So in 2015, Hannah Pashar decided to retire. She felt that she just wanted some of her own time, which was fair enough. You know, she had devoted nearly 40 years of her life to the garden. So Anthony and I got together and we spoke as a three and said, well, would you allow Anthony and I to continue running the garden in your name? You can still enjoy it. You can be as involved or not involved as you want. But this is too important. This is too special and too beautiful for it not to continue. And thankfully, I think because Hannah and I had this incredibly close friendship, she was like my auntie, even though she could have been, she definitely wasn't like my grandmother. We went to Ireland and drank Guinness together, and we went on so many adventures together. And I feel that she trusted me that I would continue her dream. This is her third child. So Anthony and I have now been working together for 10 years, which is amazing. And I have to say, he is the most inspiring, extraordinary person I've ever met. I learn something new from him almost every day. I feel like I've really come into my own curatorial style. I know what works. I know what sells. I am very passionate about also bringing in new talent, supporting emerging artists, but also using the sculpture garden in ways that can inspire the general public, ways that can help the general public as well. So especially since the pandemic, that I was very passionate about this, and then I implemented this before the pandemic. But since then, I've been very, very keen to, we host disabled groups, we host mental health groups, we host a lot of creative workshops that are not just sort of come along and learn something. It's actually a retreat. It's a bit of mindfulness and calm and escapism in the sculpture garden. And as the world is just continuing to get a little bit crazy, it's fundamental to what we do to allow people to be able to come and switch off from everything and have that sense of peace and escapism and be present in the moment. So Hannah commissioned a light installation, oh my goodness me, maybe 25 years ago, which is in the reception. And it's in her handwriting. It does look like a Tracy Emin, but Hannah did it first. And it says, come into the garden and forget all knowledge. And it means come into the garden and forget everything else that's going on. And I just think how forward thinking that was. Because it's something we say a lot now. Oh, make sure just to be present. But she coined this phrase 20 odd years ago. And that is what we did.
So there is a great deal of preparation for the annual season opener exhibition there. As the curator, can you perhaps walk us through your process as you prepare for the opener?
So we are very fortunate to work with a core group of artists year after year, some of whom Hannah scooped up from their BA or MA courses right at the very beginning. And they form the fundamental bones of each year's exhibition. We always have work by them. And that allows us to have this continual language through the garden. But each year we are also looking for new makers, whether it's artists who are newly emerging or artists who we just haven't encountered before. And we do this in a number of ways. So we try and visit as many exhibitions and art fairs as we can. Obviously, the wonders of the internet nowadays, it does make life quite a bit easier. Quite a lot of artists on Instagram and Pinterest. But we also do receive submissions, which is wonderful, because some of the artists that have submitted work, we never would have found them otherwise. And sometimes our core artists will meet another artist that they think, oh, actually, you'd be a really good fit at the Sculpture Garden. Shall we introduce you? Which is lovely. And that's how we've had some quite extraordinary pieces and installations over the years. So when we're looking for artwork, and now that we have our indoor gallery space, which we opened in 2022, we have two different lists of fulfillments that we're trying to do. So if we're looking for artwork outside, the first thing, very boringly, is it suitable to be outside all year round? You know, we have to think about how the weather could affect it, how the wildlife could affect it. I genuinely have to think about whether things are bird proof and that sort of thing, because as we are a commercial gallery, everything is for sale, or almost everything is for sale. And therefore, we have to think about, well, a client may not necessarily want to A, cover that up over the winter, or B, move it inside. So that's something very, very important that we have to look at straight away, which does whittle out an awful lot, especially when we're having work submitted to us. We then look at the quality of the work, to be honest. We look at how unique it is. And we also then look at how well it's going to fit amongst the other artwork we have on display. Some of our pieces are permanent, whether they're part of Hannah and Anthony's original collection, or they just have become permanent because the artist's work or practice has moved on so much since it was first installed. They said, do you know what, you can keep that. It's lovely. It's absolutely fine. So we have to think of everything as a whole. And so we've realized over the years that very, very abstract, very almost brutalist work doesn't work. And also, and this would probably, if people look at our website and look at the garden, this would probably be quite surprising. But we also realized that very, very figurative, very realistic work doesn't work either. It becomes a bit too Disney. But in between those two extremes, we like to have a nice mixture of everything. We also have to think about the boring logistics of being able to install the work in the garden. Because the garden itself is very delicate, we're on clay soil, which is sticky and squishy and muddy and bleh, especially at this time of year. We don't have any heavy machinery. So we have a small tractor and a trailer, and it is basically all done in manpower. The biggest pieces that we have on display, whilst placement is everything, it is fundamental, but the biggest pieces that we have on display are also in places that are logistically easy to get to. So there is a fine line, there is a little balance. That's the bullet points that we have to fulfill. And when we're looking at work, especially when we're looking at submissions, those are the tick boxes that we fill. Last year, end of last year, for the very first time, I actually did an open call for artists, which is something I've never done before. And I have to say, I will definitely be doing it again. It was fantastic. We've got some really, really interesting new artists, some younger artists, actually, which excites me. And I realised, actually, just being able to pin them into a couple of months where that's what I'm focusing on, I'm able to organise studio visits or Zoom studio visit, made life a lot easier. Because we're open 7 months a year, so we close at the end of October, and then the winter is all guns blazing into the next year. So trying to visit lots of artists, it's what fuels the creative part of me that doesn't get to make sculpture anymore. I get to go to these sculpture studios all over the UK. And I personally feel it's very important for a curator or a gallerist or whatever their title may be to visit those artists in their studios. I think A, it's a sign of respect. If you're asking an artist to lug their work across the country, then you can go and visit them. It's reciprocal. I also feel it's very important to really understand what's behind a piece of sculpture or a piece of art. Yes, you can read the statement, read their bio and look on their website, but once you're sat in their studio, looking around, smelling the smells, seeing the view out the window, hearing the sounds that go beyond the studio walls, picking up the tools, looking at the raw materials, it just gives you an extra level of understanding. And that's what I use when I'm talking to clients, because I know that I'm probably wrong in a lot of respects, but that's what sells work to me. That's what takes it from an object to a piece of art, is the story behind it, is the artist, is everything. And of course, sculpture is so tactile. So if I can describe that sculptor's studio to someone and maybe show them some photos of this was behind the scenes, I think it creates that extra dimension that is so important and so interesting. I love it. I love it so much. It's the best bit of the winter, if I'm honest. So that's the artist selection side of things.
What might be next for the Hannah Pashar Sculpture Garden?
Well, now that's a good question. We are, like I say, we're in the throes of preparing for this year's exhibition. And we have got some extraordinary work coming this year, I have to say. I don't want to say we've gone a bit mad, but if everything, touch wood, comes together, we have hopefully got an installation by a ceramic artist in Romania who will be creating a field of ceramic heads and shoulders, all of them unique. They're about 8 inches tall and they'll be on steel posts going up one of our beautiful mossy banks. So they'll look like from a distance they could be growing. It could be some sort of weird growth in the garden, which we've had before. We've had a ceramic installation like this before, or not like this, but we've had a ceramic installation before. So we're very, very excited about that. We're just, as you can imagine, the logistics of getting this much ceramic over from Romania is quite challenging. We're also hoping to have some really quite extraordinary light installations in the garden as well. We have quite a lot of ceramic coming this year, actually, which is very, very exciting because Hannah personally was actually quite an avid ceramic collector. So she loved exhibiting ceramics in the garden. Anthony and I also love ceramics. It's really hard because we just choose things that we love ourselves. And obviously we choose other things that we think are beautiful, but not necessarily to our taste, but we know they're very good. But most of the time it's pieces that we want. It's really difficult to let them go. So we also have an exciting calendar of events happening this year, which we've not done before. I will be hosting a series of In Conversation with Various Artists events, which I'm really, really excited about. It's not something I've done lectures and things in the past, but I've not done this sort of thing. So I'm looking forward to that. We've got a series of creative workshops with a wonderful practitioner called Ellie. We hosted her first one at the weekend, which was a nature journaling workshop. So very mindful, very relaxing, very calming, but also all our events have lots of tea and cake. It's English. Of course we have to have tea and cake. What else? Oh, we were also very, very excitingly, we're hosting a talk, a workshop and two installations by an amazing artist called Mary Branson. So Mary is a renowned ceramicist, but she also does the most extraordinary public art pieces, both permanent and temporary. She is a very, very big deal. And I was very starstruck when I went to her studio back in January. I was very, very nervous, but she is the kindest, warmest, most lovely person. We were talking about another artist and she said she was intimidated by him as well. So I felt much, much, much better. But we are so excited to be working with Mary Branson this year. I think she's probably the top of the ice cream this year.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for sharing your incredible story and valuable insight with our audience. It's been a pleasure speaking with you and we wish you continued success.
Oh, well, thank you so, so much for having me. It has been a true pleasure. I feel very, very honoured to be speaking to Canada. It's definitely a first. Thank you ever so much.
I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more